Every day, 5 times a day, my pocket buzzes, and the notification there says this: don't forget, you're gonna die. It's a little sobering, for sure. Welcome, glad you're here. It vibrates in my pocket at random. It's an app, and it has no set pattern. And it'll buzz when I'm sitting in a boring meeting, kind of idling away in my thoughts, or maybe I'm at a lunch appointment. It'll buzz when I'm sitting down to study, maybe out mowing the lawn. It just buzzes when it wants. Sometimes it strikes me in a moment that is worth savoring, and somehow the moment gets elevated. It's just better, it's sweeter, it's more enjoyable. A good campfire or a sunset or a meal with somebody I love. And sometimes, though, it'll buzz in my pocket and I'm in the middle of a conflict with somebody I care about and it just makes me want to break it over my knee. Or it'll go off and I'm standing at a funeral and I'm preaching and it's tragic, the story in front of me, and I just want to hate death even more, and I want to weep. Maybe it goes off when I'm at home in a bad parenting situation, and I'm losing my cool, and it either elevates me and makes me more furious, or it breaks me there, and I'm sobered by that reality. Whatever it is, Ecclesiastes has been buzzing in my pocket now for months, and I hope that these last couple of weeks, as it's buzzed around your own minds and heart, I hope it's been equally as much of a blessing as it has been to me. This is the end, the last night of the series, and we are going to be looking at the idea that memory is fading, that memory is fading. My name's Matt. I work here with families, and I love what I get to do in helping train up the next generation well. Because memory is fading, I want to take a moment and look back at some of the conclusions we've made on previous weeks. So 3 weeks ago, Schatzman was up, and he shared that time is brief, that it's like a vapor. You can't catch it. It just, and then it's gone. And he said, see the beauty of it. Just pause, noticing that time is going, and actually stop and see it. And he encouraged us to practice the spiritual rhythm of gratitude. He said, practice being grateful and turning those moments of noticing upward in praise. And then Ruzanowski followed the next week, and he shared that death is fixed, that we don't pick when we go, but death is fixed. And in the face of impending death, we got to stop and enjoy life. Really grab it and hold it and love it. And so he encouraged us in the face of that to lament, to turn the attitude of our heart when we're in grief or when we're in pain or when we're facing the depth of pain and to turn it upward in just begging God to intervene in your life. And so that was 2 weeks ago. And then last week, Schatzman shared about toil. And he talked about toilsome toil and how work is both our assignment, it's the thing God gives us, and it's our reward. It's the reward for the work we do. He said it's actually our worship is work. And so to try to summarize that, I said toil is temporary. It's just for a little while. So stop and see eternity. And he challenged us in work, the way to stop and rest from work, the rhythm of practice there would be Sabbath, that you set aside a whole day where you say, I know I could get more done today, but the list never ends. And so I'm going to set it down for a day to acknowledge God is working and I don't have to. And that brings us to tonight. Now, if the book has felt cyclical, like I could have been preaching any one of those, or any of those guys could have been preaching these. It's because the book really builds arguments, and then it goes back to them and revisits them, and it keeps looping and looping and looping. And so we get to chapter 12 where we're headed tonight, and it's a conclusion a little bit, but it's not like a good exclamation point or period at the end of the sentence. It's more of a semicolon, like just a pause of like, I hope this is a good conclusion for you. So let's look at Ecclesiastes chapter 12, and we'll start in verse 1. It opens Solomon concluding his thoughts, says, remember. Memory is fading. You must remember. So he says, remember your creator in the days of your youth. Now, days of youth, when I think days of youth, I think optimism. I think it's not yet jaded by reality or tarnished by pain. It's that sweet time that some people get. And so if I think of myself at 5 years old, I could have held the thought, someday I'm going to be president. And I could have believed it, okay? At 5, I could have believed it. Now I'm 33, and if I'm not guarding myself, my dreams are, I hope I lose a little weight, and I hope I can avoid a fight with my wife, right? I think the bitterness of age has eroded away the days of my youth a little bit. So he begins then, after this days of youth, looking at the first of a series of befores. And it feels a little bit like a good summary to the book. Before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you say, I have no pleasure in them. And then he moves on in verse 2. And I want to take the time to really read this, because I could try to unpack it and explain a lot, but I just think it's a good piece of kind of grim poetry, whatever that would be, okay? So read this with me here. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble, and the strong men are bent, and the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed, and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low, they're afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. And for whatever reason, I think 6 and 7 are maybe the most beautiful and poignant of this section. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. This feels like a man, Solomon, the man who wrote Proverbs, right? It's a hopeful book. It's like this thing that I'm saying here in Proverbs, it should be true, and they are truths. And yet, in his old age, he seems to be wrestling with that outlook of wisdom in the face of days and weeks and months and years of life that have seemed to undermine the hopefulness of some of those Proverbs. And if I could say this section maybe a different way, I might say it like this. Remember before it all comes undone. And then he ends the same way he started in chapter 1. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. It's all vapor. It's merest breath. It's smoke. Now, if you're looking at a text in front of you, you're probably thinking, you just said that's the end, and that's not the end. Well, we've been really anchored into the center part of this book, chapter 1, verse 2, all the way up through chapter 12, verse 8. And that is what the Kohelet, or the preacher, or Solomon wrote, okay? But there's another person, and the best I could come up with is calling him a compiler. He amends the end. He opens the book in chapter 1, introducing this son of David, son of Solomon, or the Solomon, son of David, and he closes it in chapter 12, verse 9, with a bit of an appendix. And I want to look at a few of the verses in this compiler's thoughts. Let's jump to verse 11. It says, the words of the wise, these words we've just read from Solomon, are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. Now, the goad is the sharpened stick that you use to drive a beast of burden along. Like when we say stubborn as an ox, it's because it takes actually hurting the ox to move the ox along, okay? And so I am a stubborn person, and gratefully for me, there are words of wisdom here that poke and prod and press me along to live differently, to step out of the rhythm of my life and look up and remember God. Okay? But these words are also nails firmly fixed. They're not just like an ouch, they're also an anchor, okay? An anchor that we can hold on to, that something that holds fast when the wind of life starts howling, and when the waves of time and death and toil continue to crash and crash. Now the compiler offers his own conclusion to the book. He says, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man or woman. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Memory is fading, so fear God. That's his conclusion. Now there's been a tension throughout the series of when do we let up? When do we pull back? Because there's this discomfort in the words. There's this pain and this anxiety there. And we want to really marinate in it, really feel it before we resolve it. And the urge, obviously, is to get out of the discomfort, relieve it as soon as possible. But we want to free ourselves from that anxiety. And the author here, he keeps hammering away this discomfort. It's like Solomon is saying, hey, I know that death is horrible, and I know that injustice hurts, and I'm not fooled by the fact that it is painful, that everything is coming undone. And then he leaves us to feel it, to really feel it. He just leaves us there in it. And he doesn't really work hard to lift us out of the pain of it. I'm thinking of times where I've been in a depth of grief, maybe at a funeral of a loved one, and someone offers me something that's true, like a real good, true truth, like that person is in a better place. And there are times where that thought feels like it's offered as an escape from the pain. I don't want to feel it. I want to get out of it. I want to release the tension of this moment, and instead of an anchor in the midst of pain. And so I don't want those phrases there. I want to sit in the grief of death stings, and this is not how it's supposed to be, and I am sad that you are gone, and this will be undone. I don't want to be freed from that. I want to be anchored through that. And it seems too like Solomon might not even believe in an afterlife. Like there are these little giveaways throughout the book. In chapter 3, he says, who even knows if the spirit of man goes up or the spirit of beast goes down? He just keeps throwing in these questions and these doubts. Like, I just don't know. He seems to be, I've worked through all the things that I could tangibly experience, and the guarantee of what happens after I die is not one I can say. And so he seems to steer away from it. And that truth shouldn't be uncomfortable. It's the same truth that Jesus is addressing in his day as the Sadducees are saying, there's no resurrection. And he's saying, well, then there's nothing after death if that's what you think. And it's the same thing that we address in our day when death is treated as the end and it's treated as the finish. There's nothing after this. Now, we would love for this book to be resolved like a good American story. A good American story is going to build, and there's gonna be tension, but right at the top, it's gonna pop, whoosh, everything resolves, it all comes down, and it's incredible. Even sometimes like the villains are redeemed, the heroes win everything, like everything is crossed and dotted. It's the culmination of 21 movies in 10 years, and you get to the end, and they left nothing undone, right? They tie every single bow together, okay? That's what we want. And that's not what he does at all. He leaves it in a largely unresolved, kind of tense place. There is a conclusion, and it's even a hopeful one, but it doesn't feel resolved. Now, my own tension is that I often want God to resolve things the way I would want them to be resolved. So I was working at a camp a lot of years ago. It feels like not very many, but when I counted them, it's way longer ago than I thought. And I was just growing frustrated because I could not hear from God. I could not hear from him, and I was just growing frustrated. And so one night, got all the kids in the cabin tucked in, made sure that my co-counselor was going to be there to cover duties, and I left and walked up the, you know, hiked up the main road about a mile up and then cut into the woods and was headed for this precipice that overlooks the lake, because if you're going to connect with God, you got to have a beautiful place to do it, right? It's just got to be there. And so I headed out there and I sat down and I just waited and I listened. And I started to get frustrated because the only thing I could hear was basketballs dribbling a mile away in the gym. Like, no wonder the neighbors hate us. We're just loud. And I'm just growing and growing in frustration and confusion. And finally, I just am resigned. It's late. I'm tired. Camp days are long. Forget it. I'm going back. And so I hike back to the road and start hiking down the main concourse back into camp. And the further I get back toward camp, the more frustrated and then angry and then bitter I get, until finally just defiance. I sit down and I say, "You're going to talk to me," which, spoiler, it doesn't go well, right? He doesn't say anything. Instead, though, I'm sitting there in this moment of silent defiance and I'm listening. And I hear something that startles me a little bit because it's a noise off to the side and it's dark and I'm not the bravest guy in the world. So I flick on my flashlight and I go over to peek and I see this. I see a dumb armadillo just splashing around in the mud in one of the drainage pipes there. And I feel incredibly small and just like foolish and as dumb as that stupid armadillo. Just, I feel like I'm sitting here flailing in the road, just like this guy's flailing in this pipe. Like, what is the point of what I'm doing? And for some reason, God was bigger and better in that moment to me. Now, Ecclesiastes has done the same thing for me. It's a book of armadillos for whatever reason. It's made me feel angry. It's made me feel dumb sometimes. I felt small, and yet, doesn't make sense. I've also felt overwhelmingly loved. Overwhelmingly loved. Now, Ecclesiastes is a book, and it was written to Jews, okay? Now, the compiler would have been probably a really good Jew, and so his conclusion, fear God, sounds a lot like the conclusion of the wisdom tradition. There's a verse in Proverbs that says, "Fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge." So there's something valuable there. He says, so how about we do the wisdom tradition and then keep his commandments? Let's go ahead and fulfill the Mosaic tradition, the tradition of Moses. He says, don't try to solve the riddle. It's probably not solvable. Instead, be a good Jew. Which for me is a pretty unsatisfying conclusion because I'm not a Jew. And the other pain here is that the main part of the conclusion is fear God, which is not a comfortable word for me. When I've heard the word fear in the context of fearing God preached, we want to do the same thing. We want to alleviate the tension. So we say it's like a respect. Like, he's really powerful, so we respect him. And I started to try to figure out how to say it myself, and I just got muddled and messed up. And so this felt like a good time to go to somebody sharper than me, who says it better than me. We're going to look at how C.S. Lewis handled it in Mere Christianity. He writes it this way, and I want to wade through this slowly because it's a quote that is just, it's somehow a hug and a sucker punch. And so I just want to give us the time to like walk through it slowly. So it says this: God is the only comfort. He's also the supreme terror. The thing we most need and the thing we most want to hide from. He's our only possible ally, and we have made ourselves his enemies. Now, some people talk as if meeting the gaze of absolute goodness would be fun. They need to think again. They're still only playing with religion. Goodness is either the great safety or the great danger, according to the way you react to it. And we, in sin, have reacted the wrong way. So if we have reacted the wrong way, the begged question is, what is the right way to react? Let's jump out of Ecclesiastes, and we're going to jump to another book that if the compiler is a good Jew, he's going to have known his Old Testament, right? And these are the things that are just going to come out of him, the things that are in his heart. And the Jews reading it are going to remember times where they've heard this same conclusion, fear God, keep his commandments. We know that. Where is it? Let's look together, Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6. Now, Deuteronomy is the story of the people of God who had forgotten, okay? God had led them out in miracle after miracle, the plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, just he had done more than I can even sometimes on my best days believe because it's just too miraculous. And these people, the sweet memory of the Exodus has faded for them. And instead, fear is running rampant. Not the good fear, not the fear God fear, but the anxiety fear, right? And they're wandering in the wilderness. In the chapter 5, just before this, the people are given the Ten Commandments. So the law, the summary of how a Jew is to be a good Jew. And then they conclude with this in chapter 6. This, it says, now this is the commandment. So this summary of them, this is what you do with those Ten Commandments. The statutes and the rules that the Lord your God commanded me, Moses, to teach you, that you may do them in the land to which you are going, that land he promised them, to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your sons' sons, just generations to come, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, all the days of your life. And that your days may be long. Hear, therefore, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Moses, here in Deuteronomy, concludes the whole of the law is to fear God and keep his commandments. And the compiler of Ecclesiastes says the whole of life, the fullness of duty of a man, is to fear God and keep his commandments. Deuteronomy continues in verse 4 with what they call the Shema. It's the morning and evening prayer of every good Jew. They would recite this over and over. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. That sounds to me like you're gonna have to work hard to remember. You're going to have to take the truth of God and just cram it into every little facet of your life, or you're going to forget. It's going to slip away. Continuing in verse 10. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you, with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of all good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant, and when you eat and are full, when the things are good and you're enjoying the gifts, the threat is that you will forget. Take care lest you forget the Lord who brought you miraculously out of Egypt, incredibly out of the hand of slavery. It's him, the Lord your God, you shall fear. him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. So if memory is fading, we fear God. I'm going to invite the communion ushers forward. We're going to start passing out the communion elements. The rhythm we're tying this to, we've done Sabbath, we've done gratitude, we've done lament. Tonight, I wanted to tie it to meditation. And this isn't the Eastern philosophy, kind of Buddhist meditation or any of those things. This isn't freeing your mind or any of that stuff. This is focusing on something worth focusing on. Like, if memory is slipping away, then what better to do than to let my heart in prayer and my mind in thought just turn over and over and over again on the one who does not end. If memory is fading, I want to think about things that are not. Peter in 1 Peter, quoting Isaiah, says, "All men are like grass. Their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of the Lord endures forever." And tonight, as our meditation, I want to focus on the word of God, Christ in the flesh. We're going to take communion as an act of meditation, an act of remembering, of holding on to. Christ, when he's setting it up, he says, "Do this in remembrance of me." So it must be something that we need reminding of. The bread and the juice, as they come around, I want you to hold them. And we're about to watch a video. It's 9 minutes long, so your hands are going to be uncomfortable holding too tiny of a cup and too tiny of a piece of bread. It's going to be an uncomfortable experience. But I hope that the discomfort is a reminder to keep thinking about what you're holding, okay? And then secondly, as we continue to remember Christ crucified, Christ resurrected, the video is going to open with a man. And he's kind of chanting a little bit the book of Ecclesiastes in Hebrew. And so if you remember, in the first week of the series, Mark talked about the word havel. He said the word vapor, the word havel, the word vanity. Havel, hevelim is the vaporist vapor, or whatever that would be. And so if you're listening closely, you can hear him say, the Hevel, Hevelim, and the son of David, Ben David, and things like that. So that's kind of cool. But immediately following that, he goes into an explanation of an origin of the earth thing that's well accepted in some scientific communities. I don't know where you stand personally, but in light of the fact that everything is vaporous and you know, we don't have to get picky on it, I want to just challenge you, don't check out when you're like, "I don't agree with that, so I'm done." Please stay here, stay with it, and let it be effective, because it's very effective. When we're done, we're going to sing just a chorus of a song together. And then after that, we'll take communion. So I realize I'm asking you, hold it a long time. You're big folks. You can do it. I promise. You can do it. All right? So let's watch this together.